Welcome to the checkout, Professor Pam Cook of the Tisch Center. How are you?
I'm good. How are you today?
Thanks so much for making time. I know how busy you are. I could just imagine this time of year. So let's talk a little bit about your role at Tisch. Like, what is the scope and areas of interest, especially in your leadership role?
Sure. So yeah, as the executive director, I kind of oversee everything. And I really think that our mission and vision describe best what we do. So the Laurie M. Tisch Center for Food Education and Policy, which we call the Tisch Food Center for short, conducts research on food and nutrition education practice and policy. And then we translate that research into resources that can be used by educators, policymakers, and advocates to give people power to demand healthy, just, sustainable food. And our vision is that through nutrition education, we can change the status quo.
That sounds right up my alley. That is amazing. So let's dig in a bit more. The main areas of research and advocacy, like how you guys apply this philosophy.
Sure. So we really see schools as levers of social change. And so almost all of our research takes place, research and advocacy relates to schools. Not all of it, but almost all of it. And what we are doing is we are advocating for really great experiences that students can have with food and nutrition education. And that can include experiences gardening. School gardens are thankfully on the rise, and so many students are getting experiences being in the garden. Those hands-on experiences, getting to put seeds in the ground and watch them grow and then harvest them, is really just amazing. Not only because of what it does for the students at that time, but it allows them an appreciation for understanding what it takes to grow food. And I think then they start to think about all of that, all of food that they eat, in a really, really different way. Very related to that is we see then our other main research area, and again, they're very interconnected, is really working on school meals, because we believe that school meals, kids need to eat while they're in school. And we have a national meals program that is set up to do that. And what we want to do is help people to understand that program for what it is, advocate for bettering that program, and then within schools to create the best and most positive meal experience we can have for all students, particularly for the students who are coming from food insecure homes that are really relying on those meals for a lot of what they're eating, making them the best that we can possibly make, and making the meal experience also a really positive food and nutrition education experience, because it happens each and every day that it can actually be a really great educational tool for kids to learn about food and eating.
So tell us a bit more, what is the food insecurity situation in New York?
So, you know, it was, even before the COVID-19 pandemic, it was really pretty severe, with, I think it was estimated over a million of the 7 million residents being food insecure at some point during the year, and went up during the pandemic. One of the challenges that we have had, and actually I've been working with some other, both advocates as well as other academic researchers, is really being able to get real-time data on where food security is happening, in what neighborhoods, who, so we can really respond to it. It's really hard to get that data in real time. Well, it's been challenging, I should say, to get that data in real time. There actually are ways that it could be done by tracking, you know, what's food pantry use, food, school meal use. There's definitely ways that it could be done that would better be able to track that and better be able to actually address it and make sure that we are getting food to people. I want to say, you know, as probably all of your listeners know, is the COVID-19 pandemic hit New York City early and hard. And, you know, when I think back of being in New York City a year ago from right now, last year in late March, April, and May, it was really, really a scary place to be, because we didn't understand COVID the way that we do now. The rates just seemed to keep going up. The hospitals were overwhelmed. Every healthcare worker I knew was being taxed. And, you know, like, for example, I have a couple in my building that are both doctors, and there happens to be an empty apartment in my building, and I happen to know the person who lives not around our building, and so wasn't there during that. And she's like, I know that one of us are going to get a direct exposure, and we don't want to expose our young son And so can you ask them if we can crash in that apartment to quarantine, you know, basically this couple away from each other? That's where it was at. It was really, really a scary time. Related to that, people need to eat each and every day. We can't take a break from eating just because there is a crisis going on, even though that crisis was massive and all around us. And so the response to get food to people was really, really massive from both a community-based response, individual communities doing all kinds of creative ways to get food to people in their community, whether that was individual buildings or community centers or, you know, whatever. There was a lot of that. And there was actually really, really massive government response. The director of food policy for New York City happens to be a good friend of mine and a graduate of our program, Kate McKenzie. You know, she had only been in that job a couple of months when the pandemic happened. And it was like it went into overload. There was then also appointed by the mayor, someone called the title was a crazy title. It was called the Food Czar. And so the Food Czar was really to oversee all of this and work alongside of Kate McKenzie and the Office of Food Policy to really make sure the government response was happening. As an aside, Catherine Garcia, who was the Food Czar, is now one of the many people running for mayor of New York City. So we'll see how that happens. And as that was even happening, even with all of that response, it actually wasn't enough to meet the need, which just shows how incredibly big the need was. And that, you know, there was a massive, massive response, despite people not knowing if it was safe to go outside, not understanding at that point in time how COVID was transmitted. And it still wasn't enough to actually meet the need and make sure we were getting food to everyone that needed food, and not just enough food and enough calories, but food that would be nourishing, help their bodies to fight not just long-term chronic diseases, but COVID if they were going to get it. And, you know, and we know that there is so much related to what people eat and diet. So diet and how diet impacts people's risk of getting both chronic diseases as well as infectious diseases, and then being able to fight infectious diseases like COVID if they have them. So, you know, it's still a situation where there is challenges. Maybe just to share a quick story, we've been doing focus groups with some of the parents that have been using the grab and go meals by the school food, which has been have been offered all over the city. And the way that it is families would need to go out each and every day. So one person that we talked to said, I have young twins who both have autism. I live in a 6-story walk-up. I have my own health problems, which included COPD, which could be trouble breathing. And she said, you know what? There is just no way. And, you know, her kids are in school online and she has to have them online during the time that the meals are offered. She's like, there's just no way I'm getting us out of the house to go down and get a meal every day. Like, you know, it's just not going to work for my family. And I think that I know there are so many families in really, really similar situations. And, you know, I really believe that the right thing to do is to have social support systems that really work for real people on the ground. Now, you know, school meals, again, they've been offering these grab and go meals. And from, if you look at it from the top going down, it has been an amazing effort because it took switching what they were serving because there was food safety concerns with hot food and making sure it was grab and go meals and getting this going in all places and, you know, having all of the issues of keeping workers safe. And then when you look at it from the other direction, which is what these focus groups are doing, is for individual families, what is working? You kind of get a different picture. And so, you know, we've been trying to balance how do we actually advocate for big systems at the top, and then making sure the way that they are implemented on the ground is really working for people.
So let's dig in a bit more. Like, what are some of the key learnings from the COVID-19 pandemic around resolving food insecurity, particularly with school food nutrition and operations and, you know, being able to execute these sort of plans?
So I think maybe one of the first things, and this is not only true in New York City, I think this is true around the country, is to realize we have a school meal program in our country, which means it is a program that basically can reach every community in the country, because obviously every community has schools. And so assuming that the schools are part of that program, it can reach those programs. Yet what we learned is that the way that the school meals had been run, because we just had this assumption, students would always be in school, right? Like if a year and a half ago you were interviewing me and one of us were to say, well, you know, there might be something that comes up that schools would be closed for months at a time and students wouldn't be in them, we would have said, that's crazy. Kids go to school. Maybe there's a snow day once in a while or a few days off due to a hurricane or something, but, you know, like not for months at a time. So, you know, what we realized through this is that when students are in schools, they're basically a captive audience, right? So they, you know, if they're getting them, they could choose to bring food from home. They could also choose not to eat, but they're there and it's a captive audience and it's happening in the school. When it switched to grab and go, it was this wonderful opportunity to provide food to not only school children, but in many, many, many places, also to other people that didn't even have children that needed food because they were right. Schools are right there in every community. Yet it's different when people are having to make the choice to go and get that food and they have to leave their home to go and get that food. It's not in a place where they are. And so I think what we can really learn from it is that schools can play a role in food security and that we have to think more creatively and outside of the box, basically, about the kinds of situations that we may encounter. I think the other learning from this is the program that's called Pandemic Electronic Benefit Transfer. So what that is electronic benefits transfer is how people get SNAP or Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, formerly called food stamps. And, you know, it's just basically the way that it's implemented. It's like getting a card, like a credit card or debit card kind of thing to be able to use for that. So that's the EBT. And then there had been something set up from a previous pandemic. I think it was Ebola, but I'm not positive which one. That was just that there would be pandemic electronic benefits transfer in case it was needed if a pandemic got severe. So it was set up previously, not for the COVID-19 pandemic, but it was on the books and it was there. And so actually in realizing that even though communities were set up to get school meals, there were a lot of people like the person I described earlier, that it just wasn't working to go out and get these meals. And so what Pandemic Electronic Benefit Transfer, PEBT, did is it gave families actually made up for the breakfast and lunch that their children would have gotten in school. So it was for all families who were eligible for free lunch. So that was either families that economically are eligible for free lunch or families that were actually part of districts that everyone got meals for free. And so just to give an example, and it was different in each state, and it was based on how many days schools were closed on average in the state for last school year. And so in New York, just to give an example, and by the way, for your listeners that are outside of New York, New York City, basically the East Coast, but New York City more specifically, schools go through the end of June. Typically, schools end in the 20s of June. So this year, I think it ends on June 25th or 26th, just to give an example. So from March to June was actually quite a few school days. So it was determined that on average, 74 school days were closed. And families got $5.70 a day, which was the cost of breakfast and lunch. So it came to $420. And that actually gave families an extra boost. It actually didn't come out that the earliest families got it was in July. And then some family, it took a while to get it rolled out. Some families were still getting it in September, but that made a real difference to families. And Pandemic Electronic Benefits Transfer actually is extended through this school year. So all the states are now that want to get this are now applying and getting this. And it's trickier this school year to figure out. Last school year, not every state, but many states, all schools were closed from a certain date in March, typically, and through the end of the school year, whatever the end of the school year was. So it was pretty straightforward. This year, there has been different situations, and obviously many schools that were open, but open only for some of the students because they were split into groups, and also a lot of schools that closed on and off whenever there were COVID cases. So anyway, that's still to be determined, and you know, but hopefully that will work. The other really important learning is that basically for this school year and through next school year, school meals are free for all students. And that is called universal free meals. And basically there's a lot of debates about this and a lot of debates over whether when we have government programs, they should be universal, like this is universal free meals, versus targeted for those who need it. And there's a lot of situations where you could argue, well, you want the program targeted. You want the people who really need the program to be getting the program. School meals, I know a lot of other advocates and academics feel the same way that I do on this, is something that really does make sense to be universal for some of the reasons that I said before. All students are in school all day. They need to eat. And basically, we want to then have the meals be something that feels like it's for everyone. Right now, it's often seen as a program that is basically a poverty program that happens to be run in schools. And so just as an example, almost all schools will describe kind of where they are economically, where the families are economically, by the percentage of students that qualify for free and reduced price lunch. Every time that is said, even if it has nothing to do with lunch, it is reinforcing that this is a poverty program in schools. And oh yeah, that program is really only for poor children. Sometimes I give the analogy of what would it be like if instead of school lunch being a poverty program, science books were a poverty program. So if you were a wealthy family, you had to pay for the science book. If you were not such a wealthy family, you got the science book for free. So just think if what we said is like, oh, this is a school where 95% of the students qualify for free science books. It would be a really different way of looking at things. And then it would be, oh, science books are a poverty program that happens to be run in school. And I'm not picking on science. I'm just giving an example, obviously. But, I think that we have this opportunity through school meals being free for next school year, especially when we hope that schools will be able to be in a more typical situation. Obviously, we don't know quite what the new normal will be, that we can actually see how this works in schools and use this as an opportunity for a lot of natural experiments of how does the perception of meals change once students get back to school, to actually then be able to say, what would it take to actually have a national universal free meals program so that it really was just like all the other parts of school, meals are part of the school day. I can tell you there's a lot of countries around the world that really see school meals as an educational opportunity. Many, many countries in Europe, Japan, other countries in Asia really see school meals as an educative part of the day and a way to teach students about food and culture and health and eating and community and less formal ways of interacting with each other. There's so many things that can happen. So I hope that that's another one of the learnings that we have is how do we make universal free meals work, as well as how do we make school meals really work for everyone, which is what we learned by them being something that wasn't a captive audience when it was people choosing to get those meals.
Yeah, I've been following Tisch Center's policy briefs and research reports really closely for the last year and a half or two. And on my own, I've been involved in food policy for several years, and I find the resources that your center puts out to be invaluable. Let's talk a bit more about some of the research and advocacy here, particularly the New York Food 2020 working group, as well as the Food Forward 10-year plan, which I've done a bit of research and writing on as well. But just talking about some of the broader policy goals, because I love what you're saying. It's brilliant. And I hope our audience starts really thinking about this, and especially school lunch as a universalist. Really, it dovetails into the right to food that we talk about a lot on the show. But some of the other policy goals that tie into that.
Sure, sure. Well, first of all, I want to just give it a really brief history on the New York Food 2020. Basically, when the pandemic started, there are two other food-related academic research centers in New York City, the Hunter Food Policy Center and the City University of New York CUNY School of Public Health and the Urban Food Policy Institute. And basically, our three centers had always talked a lot to each other, had been involved in many of each other's webinars and live events and all kinds of things. So we had definitely always known each other really well. What we hadn't done prior to the New York Food 2020 is really worked together on a project. And actually through what's called the New York State Health Foundation. And I think a lot of states have health foundations, which is actually related to the Blue Cross Blue Shield funding and the foundation from that money, really was, you know what? We are, because of the massive increase in food insecurity and the massive food response that I talked about earlier, we are putting a lot of foundations and the government are putting so much money into the response. And there is so much that can be learned from this response that if no one is evaluating it while it's going on, we're going to miss all of this learning and we're going to miss the opportunity to be better prepared the next time around. And so I remember it was one of my colleagues, Claire Raffo, who's no longer at the Tisch Food Center. She said, you know, let's email them and New York State Health Foundation may be willing to be one of the funders of this. They wouldn't be able to fund it all. Let's email our colleagues at the other centers. And I remember that, you know, it was really early on and all of us having Zoom calls all day that we all met and we said, yeah, this is the right thing to do. And what we actually learned from that, kind of as an aside, is that we had a lot of funders and we had something called the Community Food Advocates act as the hub for the funding to get the funding out for us. Because very often research projects will have one funder and then several sites or have several funders for a project happening in one place. So this was unique because it was a lot of funders for three sites. And if you know anything about getting money in and out of academic institutions, it's never easy. So it was much better to have this other source to get the money to all of us. That said, as we really started to work together and said, okay, how do we actually look at the response that happened? How do we understand food security? And you know, some of what I said earlier, which was we really need ways to understand food security, you know, in the moment and in different communities, came from the results of that research. Also, what we realized is that we did need a much stronger Office of Food Policy for New York City. And when we look at other cities around the country that population-wise are much smaller than New York City, they actually have a larger Office of Food Policy. And so we need an Office of Food Policy. And we need to understand the role of that office and what they are doing. So not just increasing it for the sake of increasing it, but really understanding the important role that the Office of Food Policy plays in making sure everyone has, as you just said, Earl, a rights-based approach to food or has a right to healthy, nourishing food all the time. And so we worked together on that and produced a report that came out in the fall that basically also looked at then diet quality, looked at the right of food workers, as well as what was happening in the retail and restaurant space. And so we are now actually continuing this research. And so we are looking at the community response. So similar to those focus groups I was talking about before that we're doing with parents, our larger group is understanding how communities are responding, how food workers are faring through this. And then we are using school meals as a large institutional program to do a case study on, and then creating systems to understand our municipal and city food system to better be able to know how to react when there are different kinds of challenges and crises that we have to face. So we believe strongly that when we are actually doing this research that is understanding the challenges, the opportunities, what's working, what's not, and the response, that we can better then be prepared for what happens in the future. So then Food Forward NYC, which is New York City's first ever 10-year food plan that was actually mandated, I think, before the COVID-19 response happened. And I remember talking to Kate McKenzie and her saying, yeah, you know, we could have said, oh, we're going to wait to get it out because we've been so crazy with the pandemic, and then said, no, we need this food policy plan more than ever. And so it came out on schedule when it was supposed to in February of this year, in February of 2021, and basically has six big goals and a lot of different strategies that are really, really wide reaching. I'll just talk about one that will I think hopefully give your listeners a flavor for that. They really are very specific strategies. It is about school meals and having more freshly prepared food in school meals. And basically prior to the pandemic in the 18-19 school year, the Office of Food and Nutrition Services in New York City did a pilot that was called the Return to Scratch Cooking, which was really meant to return all schools to doing scratch cooking, which had been done like 30 years ago. So they said, it may take us a while, maybe even 30 years to get back there, but we want to be working towards that. And we want to do a pilot that was in two schools in the Bronx. And they did a full scratch cooking menu. And
which,
so
which schools, what, by the way?
Oh yeah. It was PSMS 218, which is a K-8 school. And then the Morris campus, which is four high schools in one building. So sure. All in one building. And that happens a lot in New York cities where, yeah, where there's like a several small schools all in one building that share one cafeteria. So yeah, they did a scratch cooking menu and we did a large evaluation of it. Our report on that is called Cooking Outside the Box. And basically what it showed is that scratch cooking is feasible. It can happen. And to actually expand at wide scale, we are going to need infrastructure investment, an investment in ongoing training of this food service staff, because the staff were doing it by the end. At the beginning, they really needed the executive chef position. By the end of the school year, it was amazing. The executive chef was sitting in, they were two men, so I can say his office doing the ordering, while all of while everybody who had been there previously were cooking all of the meals and doing it beautifully. And so it just shows, you know, with some ongoing support that it can happen. But then it's also what makes sense to be the kinds of products, and does it make sense to have, which other places like Minneapolis has basically a commissary kitchen that does a lot of basic preparation and chopping. Like they have a big like a chopper that can chop things like cabbage and put it into bags and get it out to schools for making something like coleslaw. There's a lot of places around the country that are doing that. Does that make sense for New York City? Which New York City, you have to remember, is a place where getting anything around by truck on time can be challenging. So, you know, just kind of thinking about that, but, you know, thinking about what has to happen. Basically with COVID, the two kitchens, I want to say, which is something to be very proud of, have continued, their grab and go meals have continued to be scratch cooked. So they kept going with the scratch cooking, those two kitchens, through all of this. However, we know that budgets are going to be very tight. And so that what's called tactic, I think, level in the Food Forward NYC is really to say, we want to make sure that this keeps going, just because we're going to be challenged because of overcoming COVID and getting back on our feet after the pandemic. We want to make sure we are really looking at our school kitchens, not just having meals that meet the nutritional guidelines, which all schools have to meet because of USDA, but we're serving the kinds of food that is prepared by this, either the staff in that kitchen or someone close by, and being served to the students in ways that are representing the vast cultures of New York City, are expanding the students' palates, and are freshly prepared foods, opposed to foods that are pre-prepared and basically processed in the factory that are then coming into the kitchens just to be heat and served, essentially. So I think that that's an example of just one. And I think there's about 71 tactics. So I just talked about one of them. That, you know, I think could, if put into place, and all of these are put into place, could make a real difference in terms of how people eat, how food is perceived, how easy it is to actually get access in all communities to healthy, culturally relevant food.
What is the Food Ed Coalition and the Food Ed Hub that I've seen a lot of information about lately?
Yeah. So basically, as I said at the very beginning, our main area is food and nutrition education in schools. I just want to say that when I started my career, when I first started working full-time at Teachers College after getting my doctorate here, I was actually on the ground in schools doing food and nutrition education programs with students. During that time, from the mid-90s till now, more and more organizations are actually working with schools to do this programming. Some are through nonprofit organizations that are raising funds. A lot of it is getting funding through government one way or the other, whether it's through what's called SNAP education, which SNAP, remember, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, the education that goes with that, that can work in schools that, once again, are 50% or more students who qualify for free and reduced price lunch, again, mm-hmm. reinforcing school lunch as a poverty program, but that's how it's defined. And so those schools can get this education. And so a lot of the programs are funded through that, but there are more and more organizations. And then the decades that I have been doing this work, it has just increased these organizations. So what we did is I had one of my doctoral students in the 2011-12 school year try to figure out what percentage of schools were being reached by these programs. And basically what we were able to do at that point in time was figure out what schools were being reached in three of the five boroughs of New York City, which were Manhattan, Queens, and Brooklyn, and just elementary schools. And so there, and there, just to give a context of the number of schools, it was actually a little over 600 schools, elementary schools in those three boroughs. 39% were getting one of these organizations coming in and doing programs. Now, we know that schools can be doing food, nutrition, education on their own. We tried to actually have a reporting bill to try to understand that and figure it out. We haven't been able to get that through city council yet, but we can know because these organizations will provide us the list of schools that they are working in, how the schools are being reached. We then, five school years later, so the 16-17 school year, we were able to get funding again from New York State Health Foundation, so giving them another plug, to actually be able to understand and now be able to do it K-12, so elementary, middle, and high school, and all the schools in New York City, and also all of the boroughs. And so that's 840 schools. And what we found, so it was 39% of those elementary schools in 11-12. What we found, because there were so many more programs and those programs were growing, is that it was 56% of schools by 16-17 school year, which is great. That's a big increase. Elementary schools are also more likely to have these organizations working with them. So we went and looked at, and it was, there was actually a few new schools. So it was now a little bit higher in the 600 schools in those three boroughs that we did 5 years earlier. And what we found is it was 71% in those three boroughs, which was great. And so we went to city council, and actually for every single of the 50 some city council districts, every single city council member, we gave them a list of what schools were in their district that had these programs and what schools didn't. And a school was counted as having the program if only if one class got it. So if our goal is every student has this, we are much further away than what we thought. And so we were always clear on that. So that your question was about the Food Ed Coalition. That actually then had us working with all of these organizations. And we said, you know what? Sometimes these organizations see themselves in a little bit of competition because they can be looking into getting the same funding. They can be looking into working in the same schools. And it was like, you know what? We're going to all be better if we work together, if we have a coalition and we are all cheering each other on. There are more schools in New York City than all of the programs could reach. And if we think about it on the student level, more students than all of these programs can reach. So elevating all of them together, elevating the importance of food and nutrition education, which once again is giving kids those tactile experiences, gardening, cooking, understanding food justice, understanding inequitable access to food in different communities, understanding our food system. I always like to say that today's children are tomorrow's adults that are going to be facing the really severe public health consequences we have from our current food supply that is causing diets that are increasing rates of chronic diseases. They will also be facing the ecological destruction that we are having from our current food supply, and also facing the consequences of the injustices that particularly Black, Indigenous, and people of color, BIPOC communities have had of not having access to healthy food for centuries, really. And so, you know, they will be, we're hitting the nexus of all of those becoming severe crises as today's children are growing up into adults. So they need to understand our food system and understand public health, and that's what they can learn by this. So the Food Ed Hub is where we house all of this material, where we bring all of these groups together. We got funding from New York City Council 2 years ago to basically start the Food Ed Hub. Last year, and basically the New York City budget, that discretionary funding is decided in June. June last year was when we were in the throes of being in economic crises as a city. So like many, many groups, we did not get funding. We're hoping we're going to get funding again. We've been able to keep the coalition going. As a matter of fact, we are doing things like an award ceremony that will be giving awards to groups that really stepped up to the plate. So we have kept the coalition going despite not having funding this past year. And it has been a way to, like I said, everyone working together, everyone sharing best practices with each other, everyone sharing their experiences so that we can really elevate this. Because like I said before, I believe it is really, really important for, especially with our current food supply, for all children to get really great education and really great hands-on experiences with food, gardening, cooking. And then as they get older, to really understand the consequences of a food supply with 60% ultra processed foods like sweetened beverages, snack foods, fast foods, and what that's doing.
Just as a quick side note, I'm curious the policy positions on the types of diets that school food is trying to provide, particularly around bigger focus on plant-based and, you know, healthy eating, you know, protein sources, as well as the farming techniques, you know, organic and, less pesticide and input dependent. I'm just curious how that plays into it, if at all, in these discussions, since I know that complicates things a little bit more.
It does complicate things a little bit more, and I'll get to the policies in a second, mostly because what we really would need to be able to push for all of that you just said is to have a higher reimbursement rate for the meals. Because the way that our food system is set up now is if you are being more conscious about the buying, food that is more just sustainable food, at this point in time, it does cost more. And there is really no way around that. Right. Now, in terms of, meat is also expensive. And so looking at different alternative protein sources, I think is a really, really good way to go. Once again, I think it can be more challenging to cook, as well as more challenging for students to accept. And truthfully, sometimes can take longer to eat, like if you think about just eating, like, for example, eating a big salad takes longer to eat than eating something like chicken strips and fries, right? Just if you think about yourself and eating. So I think it gets complicated. We've actually done, New York City has a lot of different menus that schools can choose from for school meals. And those menus are publicly, they're actually not all on their website anymore, but as of like maybe 2 years ago, and we downloaded them all, they were publicly available from 2008 forward. And so we actually did a 6-year look at 3 different menus. So it was the regular menu, which is what a lot of schools are on, something called the alternative menu, which was started from an organization called Wellness in the Schools, which was really pushing for all kitchen. Basically, it was like the scratch cooking one that I just described, just on a lighter level, so to speak, because it was able to be done in all of the kitchens. And actually there's a pretty well-known chef in New York, Bill Telepan, who was part of this, working with his partner who started Wellness in the Schools, Nancy Easton. And so it was actually basically more scratch cooked, a bigger focus on fruits and vegetables, a little bit more plant-based. And then there's also a vegetarian menu. And the vegetarian menu does have cheese, and I think eggs are part of that too, but no meat. So it is a meat-free menu. And what we did is we looked at 6 years of those menus from 2013 to 2019, and basically categorized the entrees as what we termed home style, which is basically something you would need to use a fork or a utensil to eat, right? So for example, like a piece of chicken breast and rice and a vegetable would be a home style dish, just to give an example. A sandwich, which is, basically some kind of grain with a protein in the middle, right? That's a sandwich. And then finger foods, which is something that you usually would pick up with your fingers and eat. So chicken tenders, even pizza, like fit into being a finger food. Well, there was many more home style options on the alternative and the vegetarian menu than the regular menu. Mm-hmm. There were also more, vegetables, the variety of vegetables is mandated by the USDA. So that did not matter as well. There were also more entrees that had vegetables mixed into the entree, which is just another way to get vegetables in addition to the vegetables on the side, on the alternative and the vegetarian menu. So we're actually doing something similar now with the new scratch cook menu. And so we're comparing 6 different menus, and we're involved in that research now over 2 school years. Not this school year, but the previous 2, 18-19 and 19-20, because all the menus came out, even though school didn't happen. We have all the menus for the 19-20 school year, even that were supposed to have been served, even with the pandemic. So we're looking at those. So I think that shows that the menus make a difference. Now I forgot even what your question was. I'm really sorry. But hopefully that was interesting.
No, it was. It wasn't a question I sent you in advance, and I just wanted to understand a bit more. But that's some great context. My last question for you, gets a little bit more towards the students themselves and the relationship between food and well-being for children in schools, children and teenagers in schools, as well as the importance of food education and, you know, helping students formulate and practice these healthier eating habits as best they can. So I just want to understand how that is being addressed through the prism of healthy school meals as well.
So wait, I'm sorry. So
first would be education, the food and well-being, you know, mm-hmm. which I think for some of us should be common sense, but just to help articulate it, since we take it for granted, you know, that schools will provide food, but what's in the food, and then, you know, the role of food education.
Yeah. So, you know, I think that the relationship between food and mental health is an emerging area and something that we really need to take a lot more seriously and do a lot more research on. The research that we have on it so far really shows it's a two-way street. Basically, if you're eating well, you're going to be better able to handle mental health challenges that come up. And so, you know, it doesn't mean eating well is a remedy for things like depression or other issues. However, if you are eating well and you are depressed or have anxiety, you're going to better be able to respond to therapy for that, respond to it. At the same time is the other direction. So eating well helps mental health. If you're in good mental health, you're going to be in a place where you actually can have a sense of wellness, can have a sense of caring about yourself, can frankly have the oomph that you need right. to navigate through the challenging food environment that we have, because you're not worried about so many other things. And so it actually really is this two-way dynamic street. And I think, you know, I mean, we've all been probably thinking about, talking about on some level, the pandemic has had huge consequences on us beyond COVID, you know, just the way schools have changed, the way work has changed, the way everything has changed, and what age groups are going to be the most affected by it. And, you know, and I don't know, and I'm not a psychologist, and I'm not even sure the psychologists know, but there's been a lot of talk of it may be it's like the middle and high school age students that it's really going to take the longest to overcome this, because it's, you know, younger children hopefully had their families there for them. It was just like, okay, this is a new normal. We're going on. We still feel hopefully cared for, you know, but as you're emerging to become an independent person at the time that all of this change is going on, and, you know, your relationships with friends and school is all changing, these very monumental graduations and sport activities and, you know, whatever, you know, dance recitals, music concerts, all didn't happen. That would be things that you would, you know, all of us kind of have memories of. It's a really, really big consequence. So I think it means, as we're caring for our mental health and well-being, particularly of our youth, food can help that along, you know, so we need to be making sure we are having school meals, which is why I think, and I said a little bit on, is as schools are opening up again, and I think that there was very little eating in cafeterias, even for students that were in schools this year, you know, I think understanding more when school meals happened in the classroom in a smaller setting, what did that, with maybe a teacher or someone present, what did that allow for? How did that allow for having the meals become something that is an educational experience? How did that allow teachers who sometimes can be, even though school meals are happening in schools, very separated from it? Actually, I had another doctoral student who did a dissertation on the role that teachers could play in helping with school lunch and what would teachers need? And teachers are already so overtaxed that do we put something else on them or not? And you know, but I think that they were put in that role. So how do we enhance that? How do we build upon that to make sure we are connecting eating well with general wellness of our students? Maybe I'll just end with a couple of stories of, you know, why I believe food and nutrition education is really, really important for students. One happened a while ago, but I think is just particularly illustrative. And I believe I have many, many stories like this. So it was when iPods were new. So the early 2000s. And some of my students were teaching at a Columbia University program called Double Discovery that is for middle and high school students that would be first generation to go to college. And so they're really getting kind of academic enrichment as well as just all kinds of education through this. So it happened to be it was a Saturday morning. It was a math enrichment program. There were Columbia University students with the middle school students to do math. And so our students said, you know, they had realized, which was typical for middle school students, that they were picking up a lot of sweetened beverages, sodas, fruit drinks, sweetened iced teas, and not really aware of how much that was adding up in terms of the amount of sugar that they were having and the health consequences. Also, how much it was adding up in cost. So what our students did is they went in and they knew what they had asked them what they typically had. And so they started measuring out how much sugar was in each of those beverages and how often did they have them and adding up through the day. And then comparing that to what's recommended for the amount of sugar to have to actually be healthy and to show that they were getting 2-3 times the amount of sugar just from the sweetened beverages that's really recommended to be healthy. And yet then realizing those beverages have just become the norm, right? They're in the front of every single store they come into. So what did we do as society to make that the normal thing that they go and get, which, you know, is crazy. But then they all wanted an iPod, right? Because iPods were new and I think they cost $180. So it was like, how long would it take you to save up $180 to be able to get an iPod? So that was kind of exciting for them as well. And the session ended with all of the students actually creating a public service announcement about why to not have sweetened beverages and why to eat healthy that they all performed. And they were really, really great. So it was a nice session. I left there feeling uplifted. Years later, the director of the program noticed that one of the students who was now in high school and was still part of the program had actually become much more fit, had lost some weight, and prided herself on telling everyone that she was really health conscious and she ate healthy, despite all of the challenges it took to eat healthy, given the challenges of the food supply, she was eating healthy. And the director, who had actually struggled with her own health issues related to diet, said, how did you do it? And she said, well, you know, it all started from that day in the middle school program when we measured out how much sugar was in soda. And so it just showed that one session, and I am not saying that happened for every student that was there, but that one session had a profound impact on at least that student. And, you know, I would love to, I'm sure now, because that was a while ago, I'm sure now in her 20s, maybe even 30, you know, I would love to know if that still has had an impact on her and maybe she's had an impact on other people as well. So one more quick story, and that is my son, Ben, who is now 22, when he was in second grade, I said that I was going to take his class on a field trip. And what we were going to do is go to the farmer's market and buy food from the farmers. We have a teaching kitchen here at Teachers College called our Earth Friends Room. We came to the Earth Friends Room. We cooked the meal together. We learned about all the different parts of the plant of all the food. It was about this time of the year, actually. So it was when the farmer's markets were just starting to have a lot of greens and radishes and asparagus and stuff like that. So we cooked it all together. We ate it all together. After lunch, the students all wrote thank you notes to the farmers for growing the food and talked about how they cooked and eat the food to the farmers, which I did, by the way, copy and bring to the farmer's market and gave them all a packet of the letters all the students had written. And so what I want to share is, again, my son Ben was 7 at the time. So at the end of the day, it was the end of the school day. So he didn't have to go back to school. He stayed with me to clean up. And so we were washing dishes. And I asked him how it went. And I said, what do you think? How do you think the day went? And he said, well, Mom, I learned something really important today. And he said, what we did today felt just normal for me because we shop at farmers market and cook a lot, obviously with my job, that's what I would do with my kids, right? And he said, but I realized it was really different for the rest of the kids. And so I vowed that day that I was going to try to expand food nutrition education, which going back to our vision, I really believe everyone has good food nutrition education. It can change the status quo. And that would mean that we would be getting to a world where instead of being really different to buy food from a farmer, cook that food and eat it with people you care about, that doing that, as my son Ben said, was just normal for everyone.
Professor Pamela Koch, utterly brilliant and engrossing. I'm sort of stuttering. I'm just so amazed by the work you folks are all doing at the Tisch Center, and just want to just give you my profound appreciation for making time to speak with the checkout today. It's been wonderful to have you on. I really encourage our listeners to check out the resources that the Tisch Center puts out, to apply them in your home communities, and to really push for better food and nutrition education policies and universal free school lunch, everything that Professor Koch is talking about here. Any closing thoughts or anything else you want to share?
No, just to get involved, because if we all do this together, we can make the world a healthier, more just, and more sustainable place.
Amen. Thank you so much, Professor Koch.
Thank you.